Hello and welcome to the Honest Politics Podcast. My name's Alex Gamsik and I am the founder of Honest Politics LLC. My company does high-level political advising for people, but not for politicians. And we're changing the intro music. I like this tune a little better. We'll see how the music goes through the rest of the episode. We have another edition of Elections Questions because, let's be honest, I just had a lot of fun recording the first one. And I love doing political research for people. That's why I want to do this for a living. And if you have any questions, email alex@honestpoliticsllc.com, and there is a 99.9% chance that I will answer it on the air. You can even send in an audio file or be a guest on the podcast if you'd like. So first, we're going to look at Kira's question. When I think about the election, my main concern is that I don't know enough about policy, especially regarding economics and foreign affairs. I feel that social issues are really important, so I tend to vote for candidates who endorse progressive social policies for LGBT+ and trans people and or women. But I would like to be more well-read on other things, so I can weigh those factors into my decision. It can be difficult to determine where I should go to educate myself on these topics. I want to make sure I'm getting objective information. So I have a question. What free resources do you recommend for those who want to educate themselves on policy? And I love this question because it's very difficult in this media environment where, because our media are mostly for profit, or at least they have to financially survive in a for profit market of media, they need clicks, they need engagement, which means they're trying to find a target market, usually a target of liberals or a target of conservatives, and they need to click, get engagement, they put out clickbait, they put out, you know, slightly biased or different perspective articles. So how do you get objective information? First thing I want to say is it's okay to know that you don't know enough. That's actually the mark of a really smart person, is understanding your own faults and weaknesses and trying to make up for them. So my solution to this is there's a few places I go when I need the straight facts. One is you could go to the Supreme Court, and if they happen to have a case on this, you can read one of their decisions. Usually they have some factual information about the case and the issue in front, but it's a little harder to find and the information's more shallow. If you want really detailed, really objective policy analysis, go to the federal government and then the federal bureaucracy, so like NASA, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Forestry Service. Go to their reports on different issues and see what they have to say, because these are professionals and it's their job to do professional work on these special subjects. There might be a political appointee at the very top of the agency that the president appoints, but everyone working there is usually a professional. And it's kind of tough to break through all the way down that federal bureaucracy and impose bias on all of them. Usually, they do have a pro-USA bias, of course, but they're not as much Democrat or Republican so much as federal workers trying to do their job. These are professionals working in the federal government with the full weight of the United States government behind them to put out accurate information. So if we want to think about economics, the first thing I think about is the Congressional Budget Office. I also think about the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The Congressional Budget Office tells you everything you need to know about the United States' budget, what they project, recommended policies. Go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you can see how much unemployment is over time, who is unemployed, the amount of people in the labor force, not in the labor force. And there were tons of economic agencies. Go to the Treasury Department, scroll past all of Steve Mnuchin's like political stuff on the front page, go to the agencies within the Treasury Department. And I found a new one I never heard of called the Bureau of Fiscal Service. And they put out a 260-page fiscal year 2019 financial report of the U.S. government. Now, I didn't read this, obviously. But you can go to this and read the executive summary and get some key facts and information about the United States' financial standing. If you don't have time to do all of this, of course, that's what Honest Politics is for, is to read these reports and get you a summary. For immigration policy, you can go to the Department of Homeland Security. And then when I did that, I scrolled to the bottom and clicked About DHS, then go to Organization, then go to their org chart, their organization chart. And you can look at all the agencies within the Department of Homeland Security. You see the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. You see the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. You see the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. You can go to each of these websites and look at all of their reports and try to find the executive summaries on these reports and get the key information from there. If you can't do that, I recommend the Supreme Court. If you can find a Supreme Court opinion on an issue you care about, the beginning of the Supreme Court opinion starts out with unbiased facts having been compiled from lawyers on both sides. So you get a really clear, unbiased picture. And the Supreme Court, whatever you think, they are professionals. They have to be very qualified judges in order to get there, unlike congressmen and presidents who don't need any qualifications whatsoever. If you don't want to do Supreme Court decisions, you can go to peer-reviewed academic articles. For Kira specifically, or anyone who's been to college, I recommend going to your college's website, looking at their alumni benefits. Usually they'll let you get into their databases on the library online. So you can go to an online library database, search for social science articles, just put in the search bar whatever you're interested in. If you're interested in immigration, put U.S. immigration policy in the bar. You'll find random studies on stuff. And even if it's not exactly what you're looking for, the beginning of the academic article has an introduction. There's a discussion section where you will get key facts from researchers who are less biased than, say, the organizations I'm talking about next. You can go to a non-for-profit organization like NPR, National Public Radio, or C-SPAN. Of course, they're still competing in a media environment dominated by for-profit organizations, so they still target a specific market. NPR is very targeted to, like, liberal types, but because they're nonprofit, they're less biased than, say, CNN or MSNBC. If you absolutely have to, you can look at CNN, you can look at MSNBC or Fox News. But I recommend looking at both liberal and conservative sources and trying to compare both, see what you like or dislike, or see what the common similarities are. If CNN and Fox News are running a story and some of the facts and findings are the same, usually that's a great indicator that you've at least found something everyone can agree on, at least something that's objective. But again, in order, I would go to federal bureaucracy organizations like NASA, then I would go to the Supreme Court, then peer-reviewed academic articles. If you can't do that, go to NPR or C-SPAN. And if you can't do that, go to CNN and Fox News. Yeah, great question. Thanks for asking it. Now we're going to take a quick break before we talk about the Electoral College and election reforms. All right, now we're back. So the next question is from my friend Jody. Jody says, do we truly have a democratic process when the popular vote can be overridden by the Electoral College? Can you please explain what the Electoral College is? So it's only for the presidential election. Usually when we vote for Congress people or for your town mayor or something, you vote directly for that person. But in the United States, nobody votes directly for president. We vote for electors, which are party loyalists who are chosen by the party to represent the party, and then they in turn vote for the president. In some states, they're bound by law. In other states, they're just bound by the fact that they're trusted by the party. It was established by Congress it was established by the Constitutional Convention in the 1700s because they didn't want mob rule. They didn't want, like, public opinion should just get swayed in one direction temporarily and impose this crazy person. So the electors are kind of like the elite's way of keeping the popular sentiment in check. My biggest problem with it is that it disproportionately lets large states have their vote count less. So we would like to think one person equals one vote and we're all equal, but that's not necessarily true. So take, for example, the fact that because the Electoral College allocates elector by the number of congressional delegations, and every state gets two senators and one House member automatically, meaning basically that every elector in California, the largest state, represents over 700,000 people. And every elector in Wyoming, which is the least populous state, represents almost 200,000 people. So every vote for president in Wyoming counts 3.7 times more than each vote in California. That doesn't sound like one person, one vote. That sounds like one Wyomington, 3.7 votes, Californian, one vote. So that's not fair, and that's not democratic. That's why it's becoming more common for a Republican to win the Electoral College, even when a Democrat wins the popular vote, because these larger states with larger populations are having their votes suppressed for the presidency. There's no other way to describe it. That's what the Electoral College is doing. It was originally designed to make states more empowered because New York State was a very insular entity and South Carolina was a very insular entity. Nowadays that there's globalization, we have more national problems. Our world is more interconnected and we're more like a nation divided by states. In the old days, we were more like a bunch of states glued together by the Constitution. So I'm getting off topic, but let's see what Freedom House has to say, because Freedom House, you can Google it, is my favorite democratic organization. They rank every country in the world by how democratic they are, and they give huge reports and breakdowns on which is more or less democratic. In their report on the United States in 2020, they say, "Critics have argued the Electoral College system for presidential elections is undemocratic, as it violates the principle that each person's vote should carry equal weight. Defenders of these systems will argue that they are fundamental to America's federal structure, in which the states enjoy a substantial degree of autonomy, and that they ensure due political attention to all parts of the country's territory. In my opinion, it's not democratic and we should get rid of it." And that's about it. Next, we have a question from my friend Terry. Terry's question is interesting, and I left it to last because I think it's the most complicated. His question is, "Recently, reforms have been proposed to make our elections better. Whether it's abolishing the Electoral College, implementing ranked choice voting, or even creating multi-member districts, any of these reforms alone would be a huge improvement over our current electoral system. Out of these reforms, which ones should the Democrats focus on the most? And what would they need to do to get the reform passed?" I think this is a really fun question because I daydream a lot about, like, if we could change the government to however we wanted, what is the most effective, what's the most democratic, what's the best way to do it? The thing with all three of these reforms Terry mentioned is that they would encourage third parties, which means that the current two parties who are in power are not going to want third parties to stand a chance. So it's going to be very difficult to get this passed on a federal level. It's going to be hard to get this passed on state legislative levels, but you can get these passed through state referendum, which is basically when the citizens of a state pass something through a popular vote on the ballot. So there are 25 states that currently allow you to do this state by state. And if you want to get ranked choice voting, if you want to get the Electoral College taken care of, if you want multi-member districts, the best way to go about it is to lobby state by state and get them to do it, especially through ballot measures. If you have to choose just one thing, I think the Electoral College, getting rid of the Electoral College, is the easiest because it is the most popular and it's by far the easiest for ordinary people to understand. Instead of using electors, we would just vote. How many people voted for Trump? How many people voted for Biden? Whoever has more wins. It doesn't encourage third parties quite as much as the other two options, so at least the Democrats and some Republicans are more open to it. Pew Research Center did some polling on this year, and it showed that 58% of Americans would support a national popular vote instead of the Electoral College. This includes 80-something percent of Dems, Democrats, and about 32% of Republicans. So it's broadly popular enough that I think we could eliminate the Electoral College. Although it's tough to do. First, you would either have to pass a constitutional amendment, or like I said, you could go to the states directly. States could bind their electors to the popular vote. I know a bunch of states have done this already, but not enough states have done it to get the 270 electoral votes that are needed for president. So But let's look at the other two initiatives Terry talked about. One would be creating multi-member districts. Now, because I was limited on time and no one's paying me to do this at the moment, I'm not going to research this too much. I know it's a little complicated. Other countries have it where, like, you just vote for one party or the other. You don't vote for your congressman. And it reduces the need for a one congressman to go lobby Congress to have, like, a Air Force base stay in their district, even though it would probably be better somewhere else, but they want to keep jobs for their area and so on. So The Citizen's Guide to the Supreme Court is one of my favorite podcasts, and the one guy on there, Nazem, he wants to eliminate districts entirely. He says it would be much better if we just had, like, one just big vote for the party on this side, and one vote for the party on that side, and one vote for this other party. And that's as much as I know about multi-member districting. I think it's very difficult because most Americans are not used to it at all, and it would take a lot of technical learning on their part, which I talked about in the Advocacy Coalition Framework episode. It's hard to get that through. But ranked choice voting, which is actually my favorite reform of these three, would be fairly popular. I think it's a little more difficult to get it implemented on a national scale, but Maine approved ranked choice voting in a ballot measure in 2016, and a lot of major cities are doing ranked choice voting now. Ranked choice voting is on the ballot in Alaska and Massachusetts, of course, all on state referendums like I was talking about. New York City is going to start it in 2021. Let's look at Maine specifically, because we have data on how popular it was in Maine. Now, think about the presidential election in Maine. 48% of people voted for Hillary Clinton in Maine. 52% voted for ranked choice voting. So ranked choice voting doesn't just have appeal among Democrats, it also has some appeal among Republicans as well. If we look at some of Maine's other ballot measures just as kind of a base mark, the only thing more popular on the ballot than ranked choice voting was increasing the minimum wage and bonds for construction projects. It seems like ranked choice voting, especially if they pass in Alaska and Massachusetts, it's getting more popular. It's a fantastic way to say, I don't just like Trump or I just like Biden. You can say, I like the Green Party first. But then if the Green Party loses like it does every year, I want Joe Biden to win because he's better than Trump. And then if Biden doesn't win, I want the Libertarians in because I think they'll do less harm than Trump, who is my last choice. One thing I want to note about ranked choice voting is that it can be used as a voter suppression tool, depending how it's implemented. In Maine, it doesn't have this problem, because in Maine, it doesn't matter if you fill in one square or eight squares, your vote still counts. But you can imagine a scenario where an election official says, you have to circle in at least exactly five squares, or your ballot is thrown out. So if someone's like, I only know Joe Biden and Donald Trump, so I'm only going to write Joe Biden 1, Donald Trump 2. And then that ballot gets thrown out. That's a major method of voter suppression, because you're taking all of the lower information voters out of the voter pool. So ranked choice voting you have to approach with a couple cautionary steps, but it is so much better than just up or down on, like, one person. And it will encourage third parties, which is, in my opinion, a good thing. It's good to give Americans more choices. But it does not, as long as it's done fairly, it does not take away from people who just want to vote for one of the major parties either. It allows more freedom. So I'm a big fan of the ranked choice voting. There's also something called preference voting, where you just vote like yes or no on everyone on the ballot. There's a lot of other countries to compare to. Like I said, if I was being paid for this as part of Honest Politics' political research, I would look more into it. But alas, we've reached the end of our time for today. I hope I answered some of your questions, didn't take too much of your time. But anyway, I had a lot of fun doing this like I did last time. I might squeeze in one more episode before the election. If you want Honest Politics to do any political research for you, if you want me to do any social media posts for you, or if you want to talk to me over the phone about politics without being attacked for what you believe, then email alex@honestpoliticsllc.com or message any of my social media accounts. Have a great rest of your day, and I'll talk to you next time as we seek to discover more of the stories behind the statistics.